21. To his brother Mikhail. From Omsk. February the 22nd, 1854. At last I can talk with you somewhat more explicitly, and I believe in a more reasonable manner. But before I write another line, I must ask you, tell me for God's sake, why you have never written me a single syllable till now. Could I have expected this from you? Believe me, in my lonely and isolated state, I sometimes fell into utter despair, for I believed that you were no longer alive. Through whole nights I would brood upon what was to become of your children, and I cursed my fate because I could not help them. But whenever I heard for certain that you were still alive, I would get furious. This happened, however, only in times of illness, from which I have suffered a very great deal, and begin to reproach you bitterly. Then those states of mind would pass, and I would excuse you. I would exert myself to find a justification for you, and grow tranquil as soon as I discovered any. Nor did I ever for a moment utterly lose faith in you. I know that you love me, and keep me in kindly remembrance. I wrote you a letter through our official staff. You simply must have got it. I expected an answer from you, and received none. Were you then forbidden to write to me? But I know that letters are allowed, for every one of the political prisoners here gets several in the year. Even Durov had some. And we often asked the officials how it stood about correspondence, and they declared that people had the right to send us letters. I think I have guessed the real reason for your silence. You were too lazy to go to the police office, or if you did go once, you took the first no for an answer, given you probably by some functionary or other who knew nothing rightly about the matter. Well, you have caused me a great deal of selfish anxiety, for I thought, if he won't take any trouble about a letter, he certainly won't either about more important things. Write and answer me as quickly as possible. Write without awaiting an opportunity officially, and be as explicit and detailed as you possibly can. I am like a slice cut from a loaf nowadays. I long to grow back again, but can't. Les absents toujours tort. Is that saying to come true of us two? But be easy in your mind. I trust you. It is a week now since I left the prison. I am sending this letter in the strictest secrecy. Say not a syllable about it to anyone. I shall send you an official one too through the staff of the Siberian Army Corps. Answer the official one instantly, but this on the first suitable occasion. You must, though, write very circumstantially in the official letter of what you have been doing during these 4 years. For my part, I should like to be sending you volumes, but as my time scarcely suffices for even this sheet, I shall tell you only the most important thing. What is the most important? What was the most important to me in the recent past? When I reflect, I see that even to tell that, this sheet is far too small. How can I impart to you what is now in my mind? The things I thought, the things I did, the convictions I acquired, the conclusions I came to? I cannot even attempt the task. It is absolutely impracticable. I don't like to leave a piece of work half done. To say only a part is to say nothing. At any rate, you now have my detailed report in your hands. Read it, and get from it what you will. It is my duty to tell you all, and so I will begin with my recollections. Do you remember how we parted from one another, my dear beloved fellow? You had scarcely left me when we three, Durov, Yastrzemski, and I, were led out to have the irons put on. Precisely at midnight on that Christmas Eve, 1849, did chains touch me for the first time. They weigh about 10 pounds, and make walking extraordinarily difficult. Then we were put into open sledges, each alone with a gendarme, And so, in four sledges, the orderly opening the procession, we left Petersburg. I was heavy-hearted, and the many different impressions filled me with confused and uncertain sensations. My heart beat with a peculiar flutter, and that numbed its pain. Still, the fresh air was reviving in its effect, and since it is usual before all new experiences to be aware of a curious vivacity and eagerness, so I was at the bottom quite tranquil. I looked attentively at all the festively lit houses of Petersburg and said goodbye to each. They drove us past your abode, and at Kraevsky's the windows were brilliantly lit. You had told me that he was giving a Christmas party in Tree, and that your children were going to it with Emily Fyodorovna. I did feel dreadfully sad as we passed that house. I took leave, as it were, of the little ones. I felt so lonely for them, and even years afterwards I often thought of them with tears in my eyes. We were driven beyond Yaroslavl. After three or four stations we stopped, in the first grey of morning, at Schlüsselburg, and went into an inn. There we drank tea with as much avidity as if we had not touched anything for a week. After the 8 months' captivity, 60 versts in a sledge gave us appetites of which, even today, I think with pleasure. I was in a good temper. Durov chattered incessantly, and Yastrzemski expressed unwonted apprehensions for the future. We all laid ourselves out to become better acquainted with our orderly. He was a good old man, very friendly inclined towards us. A man who has seen a lot of life. He had travelled all over Europe with dispatches. On the way he showed us many kindnesses. His name was Kuzma Prokofievich Prokofiev. Among other things, he let us have a covered sledge, which was very welcome, for the frost was fearful. The second day was a holiday. The drivers, who were changed at the various stations, wore cloaks of grey German cloth with bright red belts. In the village streets there was not a soul to be seen. It was a splendid winter day. They drove us through the remote parts of the Petersburg, Novgorod and Yaroslavl government. There were quite insignificant little towns at great distances from one another, but as we were passing through on a holiday, there was always plenty to eat and drink. We drove terribly. We were warmly dressed, it is true, but we had to sit for 10 hours at a time in the sledges, halting at only 5 or 6 stations. It was almost unendurable. I froze to the marrow, and could scarcely thaw myself in the warm rooms at the stations. Strange to say, the journey completely restored me to health. Near Perm, we had a frost of 40 degrees below zero during some of the nights. I don't recommend that to you. It was highly disagreeable. Mournful was the moment when we crossed the Ural. The horses and sledges sank deep in the snow. A snowstorm was raging. We got out of the sledges, it was night, and waited, standing, till they were extricated. All about us whirled the snowstorm. We were standing on the confines of Europe and Asia. Before us lay Siberia and the mysterious future. Behind us, our whole past. It was very melancholy. Tears came to my eyes. On the way, the peasants would stream out of all the villages to see us. And although we were fettered, prices were tripled to us at all the stations. Kuzma Prokofievich took half our expenses on himself, though we tried hard to prevent him. In this way, each of us, during the whole journey, spent only 15 rubles. On January the 12th, 1850, we came to Tobolsk. After we had been paraded before the authorities and searched, in which proceeding all our money was taken from us, myself, Durov, and Yastrzemski were taken into one cell. The others, Spieshnyov, etc., who had arrived before us, were in another section, and during the whole time we hardly once saw each other. I should like to tell you more of our 6 days' stay in Tobolsk, and of the impressions it made upon me, but I haven't room here. I will only tell you that the great compassion and sympathy which was shown us there made up to us, like a big piece of happiness, for all that had gone before. The prisoners of former days, these were the participators in the coup d'état of December the 14th, 1825, Decembrists, who had been banished to Siberia, and still more their wives, cared for us as if they had been our kith and kin. Those noble souls, tested by 25 years of suffering and self-sacrifice. We saw them but seldom, for we were very strictly guarded. Still, they sent us clothes and provisions. They comforted and encouraged us. I had brought far too few clothes and had bitterly repented it. But they sent me clothes. Finally, we left Tobolsk and reached Omsk in 3 days. While I was in Tobolsk, I gathered information about my future superiors. They told me that the commandant was a very decent fellow, but that the major, Krivtsov, was an uncommon brute, a petty tyrant, a drunkard, a trickster. In short, the greatest horror that can be imagined. From the very beginning, he called both Durov and me blockheads, and vowed to chastise us bodily at the first transgression. He had already held his position for 2 years and done the most hideous and unsanctioned things. 2 years later, he was court-martialed for them. So God protected me from him. He used to come to us mad drunk. I never once saw him sober, and would seek out some inoffensive prisoner and flog him on the pretext that he, the prisoner, was drunk. Often he came at night and punished at random, say because such and such a one was sleeping on his left side instead of his right, or because he talked or moaned in his sleep. In fact, anything that occurred to his drunken mind. I should have had to break out in the long run against such a man as that, and it was he who wrote the monthly reports of us to Petersburg. I had made acquaintance with convicts in Tobolsk. At Omsk, I settled myself down to live 4 years in common with them. They are rough, angry, embittered men. Their hatred for the nobility is boundless. They regard all of us who belong to it with hostility and enmity. They would have devoured us if they only could. Judge then for yourself in what danger we stood, having to cohabit with these people for some years, eat with them, sleep with them, and with no possibility of complaining of the affronts which were constantly put upon us. You nobles have iron beaks, you have torn us to pieces. When you were masters, you injured the people, and now, when it's evil days with you, you want to be our brothers. This theme was developed during 4 years. 150 foes never wearied of persecuting us. It was their joy, their diversion, their pastime. Our sole shield was our indifference and our moral superiority, which they were forced to recognize and respect. They were also impressed by our never yielding to their will. They were forever conscious that we stood above them. They had not the least idea of what our offense had been. We kept our own counsel about that, and so we could never come to understand one another. We had to let the whole of the vindictiveness, the whole of the hatred that they cherish against the nobility, flow over us. We had a very bad time there. A military prison is much worse than the ordinary ones. I spent the whole 4 years behind dungeon walls, and only left the prison when I was taken on hard labor. The labor was hard, though not always. Sometimes in bad weather, in rain, or in winter during the unendurable frosts, my strength would forsake me. Once I had to spend 4 hours at a piece of extra work, and in such frost that the quicksilver froze. It was perhaps 40 degrees below zero. One of my feet was frostbitten. We all lived together in one barrack room. Imagine an old, crazy wooden building that should long ago have been broken up as useless. In the summer, it is unbearably hot. In the winter, unbearably cold. All the boards are rotten. On the ground, filth lies an inch thick. Every instant one is in danger of slipping and coming down. The small windows are so frozen over that even by day one can hardly read. The ice on the panes is 3 inches thick. The ceilings drip. There are drafts everywhere. We are packed like herrings in a barrel. The stove is heated with 6 logs of wood, but the room is so cold that the ice never once thaws. The atmosphere is unbearable, and so through all the winter long. In the same room, the prisoners wash their linen, and thus make the place so wet that one scarcely dares to move. From twilight till morning, we are forbidden to leave the barrack room. The doors are barricaded. In the anteroom, a great wooden trough for the calls of nature is placed. This makes one almost unable to breathe. All the prisoners stink like pigs. They say that they can't help it, for they must live and are but men. We slept upon bare boards. Each man was allowed 1 pillow only. We covered ourselves with short sheepskins, and our feet were outside the covering all the time. It was thus that we froze night after night. Fleas, lice, and other vermin by the bushel. In the winter, we got thin sheepskins to wear, which didn't keep us warm at all, and boots with short legs. Thus equipped, we had to go out in the frost. To eat, we got bread and cabbage soup. The soup should, by the regulations, have contained 1/4 pound of meat per head. But they put in sausage meat, and so I never came across a piece of genuine flesh. On feast days, we got porridge, but with scarcely any butter. On fast days, cabbage and nothing else. My stomach went utterly to pieces, and I suffered tortures from indigestion. From all this, you can see for yourself that one couldn't live there at all without money. If I had had none, I should most assuredly have perished. No one could endure such a life. But every convict does some sort of work and sells it, thus earning, every single one of them, a few pence. I often drank tea and bought myself a piece of meat. It was my salvation. It was quite impossible to do without smoking, for otherwise the stench would have choked one. All these things were done behind the backs of the officials. I was often in hospital. My nerves were so shattered that I had some epileptic fits. However, that was not very often. I have rheumatism in my legs now, too. But except for that, I feel right well. Add to all these discomforts the fact that it was almost impossible to get oneself a book, and that when I did get one, I had to read it on the sly, that all around me was incessant malignity, turbulence and quarrelling, then perpetual espionage and the impossibility of ever being alone for even an instant, and so without variation for 4 long years. You'll believe me when I tell you that I was not happy. And imagine, in addition, the ever-present dread of drawing down some punishment on myself, the irons and the utter oppression of the spirit. And you have the picture of my life. I won't even try to tell you what transformations were undergone by my soul, my faith, my mind, and my heart in those 4 years. It would be a long story. Still, the eternal concentration, the escape into myself from bitter reality, did bear its fruit. I now have many new needs and hopes of which I never thought in other days. But all this will be pure enigma for you, and so I'll pass to other things. I will say only one word. Do not forget me, and do help me. I need books and money. Send them me, for Christ's sake. Omsk is a hateful hole. There is hardly a tree here. In summer, heat and winds that bring sandstorms. In winter, snowstorms. I have scarcely seen anything of the country round. The place is dirty, almost exclusively inhabited by military and dissolute to the last degree. I mean the common people. If I hadn't discovered some human beings here, I should have gone utterly to the dogs. Konstantin Ivanovich Ivanov is like a brother to me. He has done everything that he in any way could for me. I owe him money. If he ever goes to Petersburg, show him some recognition. I owe him 25 rubles. But how can I repay his kindness, his constant willingness to carry out all my requests, his attention and care for me, just like a brother's? And he is not the only one whom I have to thank in that way. Brother, there are very many noble natures in the world. I have already said that your silence often tortured me. I thank you for the money you sent. In your next letter, even if it's official, for I don't know yet whether it is possible for me to correspond with you, in your next, write as fully as you can of all your affairs, of Emily Fyodorovna, the children, all relations and acquaintances, also of those in Moscow, who is alive and who is dead, and of your business. Tell me with what capital you started it. Mikhail Dostoevsky had at this time a tobacco and cigarette factory. Whether it is lucrative, whether you are in funds, and finally, whether you will help me financially, and how much you will send me a year. But send no money with the official letter, particularly if I don't find a covering address. For the present, give Mikhail Petrovich as the consigner of all packets. You understand, don't you? For the time, I have some money, but I have no books. If you can, send me the magazines for this year, or at any rate, the OZ. But what I urgently need are the following. I need, very necessary, ancient historians in French translations. Modern historians, Guizot, Thierry, Thiers, Ranke, and so forth. National studies, and the fathers of the church. Choose the cheapest and most compact editions. Send them by return. They have ordered me to Semipalatinsk, which lies in the edge of the Kyrgyz steppes. I'll let you have the address. Here is one for the present, anyhow. Semipalatinsk, Siberian Regiment of the Line, 7th Battalion, Private F. Dostoevsky. That's the official style. To this one send your letters, but I'll give you another for the books. For the present, write as Mikhail Petrovich. Remember, above all things, I need a German dictionary. I don't know what awaits me at Semipalatinsk. I don't mind the service much, but what I do care about is... Exert yourself for me. Spend yourself for me with somebody or other. Could they not transfer me in a year or two to the Caucasus? Then I should at least be in European Russia. This is my dearest desire. Grant it me, for Christ's sake. Brother, do not forget me. I write and scold you and dispose of your very property. But my faith in you is not yet extinguished. You are my brother, and you used to love me. I need money. I must have something to live on, brother. These years shall not have been in vain. I want money and books. What you spend on me will not be lost. If you give me help, you won't be robbing your children. If I live, I'll repay you with interest, oh, 1,000-fold. In 6 years, perhaps even sooner, I shall surely get permission to print my books. It may indeed be quite otherwise, but I don't write recklessly now. You shall hear of me again. We shall see one another some day, brother. I believe in that as in the multiplication table. To my soul, all is clear. I see my whole future and all that I shall accomplish plainly before me. I am content with my life. I fear only men and tyranny. How easily might I come across a superior officer who did not like me, there are such folk, who would torment me incessantly and destroy me with the rigours of service, for I am very frail, and of course in no state to bear the full burden of a soldier's life. People try to console me. They're quite simple sort of fellows there. But I dread simple men more than complex ones. For that matter, men everywhere are just men. Even among the robber murderers in the prison, I came to know some men in those 4 years. Believe me, there were among them deep, strong, beautiful natures, and it often gave me great joy to find gold under a rough exterior. And not in a single case, or even two, but in several cases. Some inspired respect, others were downright fine. I taught the Russian language and reading to a young Circassian. He had been transported to Siberia for robbery with murder. How grateful he was to me. Another convict wept when I said goodbye to him. Certainly I had often given him money, but it was so little, and his gratitude so boundless. My character, though, was deteriorating. In my relations with others, I was ill-tempered and impatient. They accounted for it by my mental condition, and bore all without grumbling. Apropos, what a number of national types and characters I became familiar with in the prison. I lived into their lives, and so I believe I know them really well. Many tramps' and thieves' careers were laid bare to me, and above all, the whole wretched existence of the common people. Decidedly, I have not spent my time there in vain. I have learnt to know the Russian people as only a few know them. I am a little vain of it. I hope that such vanity is pardonable. Brother, be sure to tell me of all the most important events in your life. Send the official letter to Semipalatinsk and the unofficial, whither you soon shall know. Tell me of all our acquaintances in Petersburg, of literature, as many details as possible, and finally of our folks in Moscow. How is our brother, Kolya? What, and this is much more important, is Sister Sasha doing? Is Uncle still alive? What is Brother Andrei about? I am writing to our aunt through Sister Vera. For God's sake, keep this letter a dead secret and burn it. It might compromise various people. Don't forget, dear friend, to send me books. Above all things, histories and national studies, the OZ, the Fathers of the Church, and Church Histories. Don't send all the books at once, though as soon after one another as possible. I am dispensing your money for you as if it were my own, but only because your present situation is unknown to me. Write fully about your affairs, so that I may have some idea of them. But mark this, brother, books are my life, my food, my future. For God's sake, don't abandon me, I pray you. Try to get permission to send me the books quite openly, but be cautious. If it can be done openly, send them openly. But if it can't, then send them through Brother Konstantin Ivanovich, to his address. I shall get them. Konstantin Ivanovich, by the by, is going this very year to Petersburg. He'll tell you everything. What a family he has, and what a wife! She is a young girl, the daughter of the Decembrist Annenkov. Such a heart, such a disposition, and to think of what they've all been through. I shall set myself, when I go to Semipalatinsk in a week, to find a new covering address. I am not quite strong yet, so must remain here a while. Send me the Quran and Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and if you have the chance of sending anything not officially, then be sure to send Hegel, but particularly Hegel's History of Philosophy. Upon that depends my whole future. For God's sake, exert yourself for me to get me transferred to the Caucasus. Try to find out from well-informed people whether I shall be permitted to print my works, and in what way I should seek this sanction. I intend to try for permission in 2 or 3 years. I beg you to sustain me so long. Without money, I shall be destroyed by military life. So please. Perhaps in the beginning, the other relatives would support me too. In that case, they could hand the money to you, and you would send it to me. In my letters to Aunt and to Vera, though, I never ask for money. They can guess for themselves that I want it if they think about me at all. Filippov, before he left for Sebastopol, gave me 25 rubles. He left them with the commandant, Nabokov, and I knew nothing about it beforehand. He thought that I should have no money. A kind soul. All our lot are doing not so badly in banishment. Toll has done his time and now lives quite tranquilly in Tomsk. Yastrzemski is in Tara. His time is drawing to an end. Spieshnov is in the Irkutsk government. He has won general liking and respect there. That man's is a curious destiny. Wherever and in whatever circumstances he may appear, even the most inaccessible people show him honour and respect. Petrushevsky is now and then not in his right mind. Monbeli and Louv are well. Poor Grigoriev has gone clean out of his senses and is in hospital. And how goes it with you? Do you still see a great deal of Madame Plesheev? What is her son doing? From prisoners who passed through here, I heard that he is alive and in the fortress at Orsk, and that Golovinsky has long been in the Caucasus. How goes your literature and your interest in literature? Are you writing anything? What is Kraevsky about, and what are your relations with him? I don't care for Ostrovsky. I have read nothing by Pisemsky. Drashinin I loathe. I was enchanted with Evgenia Tur. I like Krestovsky too. I should like to have written much more, but so much time has gone by that even this letter was somewhat difficult to write. But it really cannot be that our relation is altered in any respect. Kiss your children. Can they remember Uncle Fedya at all? Greet all acquaintances, but keep this letter a dead secret. Farewell, farewell, dear fellow. You shall hear from me again, and perhaps even see me. Yes, we shall most certainly see one another again. Farewell. Read attentively all that I write to you. Write to me as often as possible, even if officially. I embrace you and all yours more times than I can count. Thy Dostoevsky. P.S. Have you received my children's story? He means The Little Hero. The story did not appear till 1857 in the OZ under the pseudonym M.Y. That I wrote in the fortress? If it is in your hands, don't do anything with it, and show it to no one. Who is Chernov that wrote A Double in 1850? Till next time. Thy Dostoevsky.